Well, here we are.
It is time, Simba.
If you understand that reference, you might be about the age where we should be working together. It's possible. But it is now one of 3 times a year that I'm accepting clients for my freedom framework, overcoming food sensitivities and increasing energy without unnecessary restriction. My goal for my one-on-one clients is to take them through frameworks and explore tools for achieving 50, 80, 90% of their goals in just a few months and show them how to continue to heal on their own so they don't need me anymore. Honestly, I think we're doing great one-on-one work here, helping women that would otherwise be falling through the cracks, thinking that they're just aging, that they're just moms, that they just, and it may be true that they just have stress, when really those stress hormones and their other core systems just really need some serious support and some serious love to serve them for years to come without symptoms. So if you'd like to clear inflammation, eczema, food sensitivities, or improve energy and brain clarity, I'd love to chat with you. You can book a call with me at kristabigler.com/FSS, kristabigler.com/FSS, and that link will be in the show notes.
There's a difference between healthy habits and wellness rituals. Like habits are regular settled tendencies, right? And a tendency that we tap into when we've got enough time isn't going to be enough to command and change biology. Whereas when we begin to stack healthy choices, one of those being, I'm just going to move more in my day. I'm going to look for opportunities to move. Like the needle really starts to shift.
Stress is the inflammation that robs us of life, energy, and happiness. Our typical solutions for gut health and hormone balance have let a lot of us down. We're over-medicated and underserved. At The Less Stressed Life, we're a community of health-savvy women exploring solutions outside of our traditional Western medicine toolbox and training to raise the bar and change our stories. Each week, our hope is that you leave our sessions inspired to learn, grow, and share these stories to raise the bar in your life and home. Did you know that food sensitivities, low energy, and skin issues can all be caused by inflammation related to immune system imbalances? That means in order to heal your symptoms, you need to bring your body into balance. And in order to do that, we need to develop a resilience to stress. That's why I've created the Immune Resilience Protocol, which is a personalized framework that combines nutrition and the nervous system to help you fix your inflammatory issues. By optimizing the 4 core organ systems, the gut, detoxification systems, thyroid, and adrenal health, we heal and nourish your body from the inside out. The results are that most of my clients reduce their symptoms by at least 50 to 75% in just the first couple of months working together. And since I teach you in smart yet simple terms the proven frameworks I use, you'll be educated and empowered to continue healing, improving, and sustaining your health on your own so you don't have to rely on seeing me forever. If you want to learn more about food sensitivity and fatigue freedom, which is open now, my calendar is open now for the last time in 2023. I won't take clients again until early 2024. I'll have calls available just through September to assess your case one-on-one and see if it's a good match to work together. You can book a call or learn more at kristabigler.com/FSS. That will be in the show notes or just kristabigler.com and navigate in the navigation bar. Talk to you soon. Today on The Less Stressed Life, I have Dr. Dwight Chapin, who is a trusted expert on human performance and injury prevention as an award-winning chiropractor, co-owner of a large multidisciplinary wellness clinic. And he's the team chiropractor for the Canadian Football League's Toronto Argonauts and the on-site clinician for the Globe and Mail. He's made it his life's mission to care for, educate, and inspire others in their journeys toward optimal health. In his first book, Take Good Care, 7 Wellness Rituals for Health, Strength, and Hope, he brings the science of preventative medicine to life. And I'm going to add with stories. So we're going to talk a little bit about those stories and try to make them kind of fun and cool and whatnot. So welcome, Dr. Chapin.
Oh, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah. So when I was opening up all of this today and looking at how you're a chiropractor, I was just sharing offline anything that falls under the triad. I don't know if I made this up or if I found this somewhere, but I think that health is often in a few different angles. And I think there's a structural component and an emotional and mental component and a nutritional component. And so any of those things are fair game here. But here you are a structural generalist, that's what we would stereotype you to, right? Clinician, kind of getting into something that doesn't necessarily feel naturally like your normal thing, right? It kind of feels more lifestyle. So maybe it is structural, right? Because it's the structure of lifestyle, but it's a little bit different. So why don't you tell us about how you got interested in this? Because what it feels like this book is a compilation of like interesting people that you interview. It feels like a book version, kind of a podcast.
Okay. So great start, because this is where a lot of people come to this topic and they see my background as a chiropractor and there's immediately a question mark. And so where I like to begin is, as a musculoskeletal expert, like, posture tells the truth. There's just no hiding from. And I have this unique vantage point to observe the health impact of daily lifestyle choices and routines. And over the course of my career, I've had the opportunity to care for leaders in a variety of different industries, in media, sports, entertainment, healthcare, education. And I find that leaders sort of fall into one of two buckets. There are those that just go all out and often sacrifice their own personal well-being or their self-care practices in pursuit of a goal and pay a dear price for that. And they'll end up in my office looking for me to fix something that the physical or the mental stress often manifests as back pain, shoulder pain, neck pain, headaches, and those are things that fall into my scope of practice. And then the other group are those that pursue excellence and pursue a goal and are able to maintain their commitment to health and well-being, and not just for themselves, but also their teams and those within their communities. And those are the people that in my 25 years of practice that have just always fascinated me. And in supporting their musculoskeletal health, I've had the opportunity to study their practices. And those are the folks, those are the stories that I wanted to focus on in this book, to bring the evidence to life and show people that better is not just possible, but it's within their grasp.
And this is how it's actually happening. You know, this reminds me of, I often say I love common denominators, and it feels like you like pattern recognition as well. So
you're
looking at these high performers, and like, how come they get better and they stay better? And then you start asking them questions about their life. And you came up with, I guess you distilled this, right? Because there's a lot of overlap in maybe points or facets that maybe what these people did, right? So you kind of distilled this down to what you called 7 rituals. Is that correct?
So to bring the evidence to life, I wanted to tell these powerful stories of these individuals. And I just, in practice, that works, right? When you can get a patient to understand a story, it's motivating and it shows them that even top performers can sometimes struggle in the creation of their formula. And an approach to self-care, it's not a set it and forget it strategy. You have to constantly be nurturing that approach. So as I started to bring together this group of individuals, I call them mentors in the book, and they started interviewing and working with the mentors and studying their lifestyle practices. There are 21 featured in the book, and I got to about the 6th individual, and I started to recognize those patterns. And within the book, there are senior executives who are in their mid to late 70s, and there are Olympians that are in their mid to late 20s. And there was a common ground to their excellence. And that common ground is what I refer to as the 7 wellness rituals. So we can talk about those if you'd like, but each of them incorporates those 7 rituals within their formula. And they all do so differently, which is what I found fascinating. So while they're all present in their formula, there are times in their lives where they'll lean a little harder in one direction more so than another. And so that unique approach is, I think, one of the real cool features that came out of this research.
Well, let's walk through those rituals, and I'll take notes and reiterate things. But if possible, if you can kind of incorporate some of their stories as we go to help us remember the rituals, it would be so appreciated.
Yeah, sure. So the first one is prioritize sleep, rest, and recovery. And if we come back to those two leaders, the leader that just pushes hard and goes until they collapse, perhaps not respecting sleep like we need to. In sleep, we tap into our healing potential and support our cellular repair. And one of the individuals that I met with was Jim Tree Living. And Jim is the owner of Boston Pizza, and he's built his empire around that restaurant franchise, and now his net assets over $1 billion, and he's involved in all kinds of different things. In an early part of his career, he pushed literally to the point of collapse, and it almost cost him his life. And he had to take a step back, take a leave, and recalibrate And his recalibration was found in prioritizing the need for sleep. And that came out of a respect for the biological power that he could tap into in sleep. And so people that struggle with sleep, and roughly a third of us aren't getting enough sleep, and somewhere between 50 and 70% don't get quality, high quality sleep. And that puts us on a fast track to chronic disease and burnout. And so when we tap into sleep and we nurture that our mind and allow our bodies to recalibrate and support our immune function and help our brain detoxify as we flush out some of the memory impairing proteins that accumulate in the brain as we move through our day, we just can tap into a healing potential. So in that first ritual, it's really looking at both length and quality of sleep, and it's helping individuals form a strategy around a pre-sleep ritual. Mm-hmm. I find a lot of people will push hard all day and then look to sleep as almost an inconvenience. They can, all right, well, now I'll flip the switch, and their head hits the pillow and they struggle to turn off their mind or their to-do list. And that can start a downward spiral. So Insufficient sleep syndrome is linked to all kinds of chronic health problems.
I would agree with you that I have to mathematically calculate sleep with very brilliant people much more often than I would expect to, because we might know something, but we don't always do it. What would you say to that 50 to 70% of people who aren't getting good quality sleep and they want to, but they are struggling? I know that's an entire book in itself, but if you can try to offer a little bit of support for those people for, in maybe a sentence or two, then what would you say to them? They want to get sleep, but they're struggling.
Sure. One of the experts in the book is Dr. Robin Hanley DeFoe, and she's a stress resiliency expert and a best-selling author. And when we're discussing sleep, and I was working with her, she said the last thing we want to do is create more anxiety around the need for sleep and how important it is when people are struggling to sleep. And so what she does is she moves to sleep 60 minutes before she wants to be asleep. She starts her ritual and winding down. She uses light to her advantage. She offloads all of her to-dos in her journal. And then she'll do a calming activity. And one of the things that I really like about her approach is that she looks to get the average amount of sleep that she needs, which is about 8 hours a night. And she tries to achieve that average in 3-day windows. So if life goes sideways one day with a busy day in her practice or with needs of her kids or something, she doesn't get anxious about it. She just plays to that 3-day average. And by locking in her pre-bed ritual to wind her nervous system down, she's able to fall into sleep easier. And that ritual for her involves, as I said, dimming lights. She uses a Headspace app and does a sleep story and just is selective with who she's spending her time with in that hour.
I think that's reasonable stuff that anyone could leverage.
Yeah.
All right. What's the next ritual?
The ritual two falls right into your expertise, and that's consume healthy fuel. And that's really looking at what is our relationship with food. What I was really struck with in working with these individuals is they all look to food and their diet as a strategic therapeutic tool that has a direct influence on health and performance. And not one of these individuals actively dieted. Some have a very healthy relationship with food. Some do not. Some have to really work hard at the choices that they do make. But the ritual is really centered around, all right, how can we minimize chronic inflammation in our body and gain access to the body's healing potential through making healthy choices in our diet and the beverages that we consume?
You said they all focused on food, but is it correct to say that they all had a little bit different approach, or were there common denominators in some of their approaches?
It was using food as a therapeutic tool. And so they all would, if they were on this call with us, they'd all talk about how they don't deprive themselves, how they enjoy food as a part of celebration of life. And I think that's a really important strategy. But at the same time, the choices that they make and the discipline that they bring to the food that they eat and when they eat, there definitely was a common denominator there. And that was that their performance and their long-term health always had a priority over the immediate gratification of a snack or a cheat. And so they kept coming back to that choice point with their performance being the leading driver.
All right. What's the next one? I think that could also be a whole topic on its own, right? Which is okay. And I don't need to get into it. But what I appreciated about that was that in 21 people, you saw a good sampling of the population that a lot of people struggle with relationship to food, but they still considered it an important piece. And what I appreciate for sure, not being depriving with food, because I think it becomes more of an emotional control thing, et cetera. I mean, that's all food relationship stuff. I think there's a lot of fear around food that I don't subscribe to. I'm more of like a, how do you tolerate this food? It is possible. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate you mentioning that. All right.
Yeah. Ritual three looks at fighting for your waistline, and it's all about energy management and metabolic health. We want to look good. We want to feel good. And we're spending billions of dollars on weight loss strategy and nutritional health. And in looking at the research and working with these individuals, it's clear that we all have very unique needs in our diet and in the management of our health and weight. And one of the dietitians that was consulting with me on the book, and also one of the mentors in the book, is Jennifer Zygo. And Jennifer's the dietitian for the Toronto Raptors, as well as the Canadian Olympic team in Gymnastics Canada. And I just love her unique approach. She just sits with all of her athletes and begins with understanding what it is they need out of their nutritional health. And we're looking at dietary choices and resources that are available, and cultural background and emotional state and medical history and the differences in their metabolic health, their gut microbiome, their genetic predisposition. All these factors come into play in her dietary recommendations to help people manage and achieve a healthy weight. And one of the struggles that I see in practice is that majority of adults are consuming ultra-processed foods and living sedentary lifestyles, and that is a deadly combination. As long as we continue to make those choices, then we're putting ourselves at significant risk. And so the choices that we are making, and not just the foods we're eating, but when we're eating them and how that influences our overall emotional health and mental health, has a huge overplay in weight management.
Would you say that ritual two and three feel like there's a lot of overlap, or what do you think are some of the key differentiators there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ritual two, we're really looking at actual choices and timing of meals, whereas in ritual three, it's trying to develop an understanding of how the body uses energy. How can we get more through our lifestyle choices and practices? How can we influence the way in which body stores energy, uses energy, and the impact that has on weight?
Would you include, is this where you would fit in muscle building, et cetera, or is that in a different ritual?
That falls a little bit later. Yeah.
Okay. What would you say to people, since I feel like this ritual, you could get pushback from some people, right? So if you use, you know, the words fighting for your waistline, which this is used for sure from longevity experts, they talk about this. But then there's a whole different camp of people. Usually when there's food relationship issues, sometimes there's a big overlap on that. And there's the whole health at every size camp. So what would you offer to those people who feel like they want to push back about this ritual?
Yeah, this is the topic that really gets people's attention. And it's an important conversation. So I like to start there. If we're looking at weight management, I'm not one that subscribes to chasing a number on a scale. When I talk about fight for your waistline, in my mind, that fight is we're up against evolutionary forces that made humans particularly good at storing fat as a great resource to energy for a rainy day down the road. And so when we're looking at lifestyle choices and trying to influence the quality, the energy that we have access to be able to be all we need to be and want to be in the world, what choices are we making that will help influence that access to that energy and reduce risk of chronic disease? And that's where I think the conversation around weight management begins. And in my mind, the fight is that fight against the evolutionary forces. It's not to chase some magazine style waistline.
I think that was a good distinction to discuss. So, all right. Every one of these is like a whole big topic, right? But what's the fourth ritual that you found is from these mentors?
So the fourth ritual is move to stay young. And this is all about your daily routines and how we bring movement to your day when we're practicing. By bringing a variety of different movements to our day and challenging our range of motion, challenging our strength, our balance, our coordination, then not only do we improve the quality of our movement, but we also change how the body ages. So on average, we're spending a little less than 10 hours. In Canada, the average is 9.6 hours a day behind a screen. And if we were to take one of those hours and replace it with a moderate walk, we could reduce all-cause mortality by as much as 30% and all major depression by as much as 26%. So in that strategy of the ritual of move to stay young, the practice is really focused on two things. One, how can we break up periods of sitting? So I tell my patients, within every hour, you got to get up and just change the way you're loading your body. It can be a stand to a washroom break, or it could be simply a stand in a quarter squat or a high knee or a bend. just something to engage your core muscles and change the loaded posture of sitting. So move every hour. And then the second ritual or goal within this practice is to try to accumulate up to 150 minutes of moderate activity every week. Now, that is a lot for some people. And so just start by bringing movement to the day, by breaking up periods of sitting is a great place to start. And then gradually increasing in 10-minute increments, trying to get your heart rate elevated. And when we do, we significantly reduce the risk of chronic disease.
So you are a structural expert. You see how people are handling things. So I have some questions about movement. Let's say people start lifting heavy weights and then they start to get all kinds of pain. I guess I'm kind of wondering about, let's talk about maybe quality movement. You brought up quality movement. And yeah. I think sometimes for me, like you work in structure, I work in nutrition that kind of, you know, we both, I'm sure, overlap into a lot of other areas. And so maybe our areas don't feel foreign to us, but neither, and I don't know, maybe you consider yourself a movement expert as well. But I think sometimes people, like what you said was really simple, but when we're talking about quality movement and beyond that, what would you maybe offer for that as well? I feel like this can get complicated. Like even when I come up with standing, creating, like these things take some effort and work for people to get done, right? I think that they do.
If we step back from this ritual just for a second, and I think one of the important distinctions that I try to bring out in this book is the whole idea that there's a difference between healthy habits and wellness rituals. Like habits are regular settled tendencies, right? And a tendency that we tap into when we've got enough time isn't going to be enough to command and change biology. Whereas when we begin to stack healthy choices, one of those being, I'm just going to move more in my day. I'm going to look for opportunities to move. Like the needle really starts to shift. Sleep quality improves, energy improves, the quality of movement that you were just asking about also improves. So what does that mean? Well, that means like you're moving your two-year-old out of the back seat of the car, in and out of their car seat is different. The way you're loading or unloading groceries is different. The way you feel when you get out of bed is different. So I encourage all my patients to just look for opportunities to just get a little bit more creative. I'm 50 years old. I start every day now with a movement practice. And it's about, depending on how I feel in the morning, it's 5 to 7 minutes long. And that's just how I start the day. And that gets my body moving better. But it's also me investing in my self-care at the beginning of my day that sort of gives me a little bit of a mojo to get going in the day. I feel like, okay, I'm ready for the day. So it's just looking for opportunities to practice movement. And we are not going to be able to move well as we age if we're not practicing. And that's a concept that's really foreign to a lot of people. They take their movement for granted until all of a sudden it's not there.
Yeah.
And I had a gentleman in the clinic 2 days ago, and he's 45 years old. He's been sedentary for most of the winter. As the spring came and he started golfing and getting active in the backyard, he's hurt his back. And now he's 2 days into his treatment and frustrated with his inability to move. Well, he's got weeks of rehab coming his way. And he just wasn't aware of how gradually he was losing his functional range of motion. It was just not on his radar. And the lack of mobility was really, in his mind, just sort of part of the aging process.
I mean, it happens when you're not using these functional movements. Your lack of mobility or your muscle starts to atrophy in as little as a couple of days, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes right into the next wellness ritual, and that's to protect your strength. And this is another one that really catches patients off guard. And our muscle strength builds until we're about the age of 30 years old, at which point it starts to decline. And that rate of decline is anywhere between 5 and 8% per decade. It's a little faster, a little slower in some cases, depending on the individual. And that loss of muscle strength and function that's a part of aging, which is called sarcopenia, it doesn't have to be the way it is. We have some control over it. The research is showing us that it's not necessarily an inevitable consequence of aging. It has more to do with disuse. And as we're not using our body, then there are other biological ripple effects that come from that. So by investing, again, a bit of time in some resistance training, really light movements, it doesn't have to be a gym membership. It doesn't have to be heavy weightlifting. It could be body weight. Just simple movements where you're challenging your physical strength. Not only does movement quality again improve, but the research shows us that we also can improve sleep, energy, weight management, the amount of visceral fat we have, our insulin sensitivity improves. our brain health, bone health, cognitive function all improve. And this is with a really small investment of time, 15, 20 minutes twice a week with some light weights and a yoga mat. You can really hold off some of the loss of strength that many people do experience as they age.
You know, I've heard some people I respect say that variety is the enemy of a beginner in training. And I would wonder if you have any comment about that. And or what I was trying to say earlier, and I think people have this issue in any time they're trying to create a new ritual or a new thing, or they want to change their diet, they're like, they struggle with what's inside themselves. So they kind of look for resources outside of themselves, which is okay. But what I'd like you to offer is, can you offer some examples of literally, here's what you could do today to get started? Like, just,
yeah,
this is what you could do that would be really smart.
Right. So thank you for that, because I'll see people that'll come into the office that go from zero to 100 in a 2 week span.
Yeah.
And then they end up injured. Right. And not only are they now injured and in pain, but now they're even more frustrated in their body's inability to move. And that can start a mental health downward spiral that's really toxic.
That's what I was trying to articulate before, but could not quite get it.
No,
thank
like
you.
you're bang on. So, okay. I like to talk about just simple human movements. Like, can we talk about a push, a pull, a squat, a hinge, a lunge? These are just simple movements that we do every day. So many people will spend a good part of their day behind a screen. And so just simply a wall angel where you're just pulling your shoulders down and back and feeling a stretch across your chest as you bring your elbows down, almost like you're trying to tuck your elbows into your back pockets. And you want to stack your posture so that your ears are lined up over your shoulders and your shoulders over your hips. And then after three or four of those wall angels, then just rolling through some shoulder rolls in both directions, just to bring a little bit more blood and oxygen circulating through our upper back muscles. That's enough in that 1 hour that you've been sitting to sort of break up that loaded position or posture. But when it comes to exercises, like, people will go on Instagram and they'll come in and they're doing like all kinds of crazy pistol squats and things that they have no business doing. And it's the new exercise that they're focusing on, or they've just come out of the gate too hot. And so I say, let's just get a baseline level of physical activity. And starting with just a walking program is the best place to start. It's just a fantastic exercise. It's great for mental health as well as physical health. And after 4 to 6 weeks of a walking program where you're achieving that 150 minutes a week, then we've got something that we can build a strengthening program on. And I'll usually start with just really simple movements on a yoga mat with a patient, doing planks, bridges. There's an exercise called a bird dog or cross crawl. And on the book website, 7wellnessrituals.com, I've partnered with McLeod Bethel Thompson, who's the quarterback of Toronto's football team. And there's a variety of videos showing all these basic human movements and exercise programs that's free and available for anybody to use. And listeners can go to that for some suggestions on how to bring just basic human movements into their day with simple exercise and not a lot of equipment.
Yeah. One thing I have gotten stuck on over the years is being in a program where I have so many weights and then I travel and then I get off of it. And so it's, I think as I assessed that not so long ago, I thought, oh, I need to have a core regimen that I do. And so I like when you brought up push, pull, squat, hinge, lunge. If you cannot use these biomechanical or functional movements of your body, well, then maybe there needs to be some strength brought to that area, or maybe I need to work on it differently. And I want to just offer also, when you mentioned the fourth ritual, that you started a movement practice that's 5 to 7 minutes in the morning. I appreciate the emphasis on the time there, because so often, and as we talk about this, it's like, you know, these are all very important things, but they fall apart, right? Like, as you said, so people either let their self-care stuff go or they feel like it's too much. So I always love to hear things that are 1 to 3 to 5 to less than 10 minutes and don't feel like a huge time suck, because 5 minutes feels pretty doable, honestly.
Yeah, for real. And even when people look at the 150 minutes and they're at 0 minutes, it can be intimidating. It can be upsetting. And I say, okay, so we have 10,000 minutes in our week. And if we're getting enough sleep, we're practicing ritual number one. We've got roughly 6,700 minutes that we're awake every week. And so we're looking for 150 of those minutes. That's 2.5% of your week, right? So when you chop it down and we examine in the creation of a formula that involves these seven rituals, and we're looking at, like, what's your motivation? What's your why? Why are you going to want to get up in the morning and do that ritual or that practice? And it's linked to something bigger than just, oh, I have to do this because...
Right. right?
Then it sticks, right? That's when it starts to convert from a habit to a ritual. So the suggestions made are all meant to be very easy to implement and easy to access.
Yeah. Ritual does have a different tone to it, doesn't it? It's not a habit. Habit's been used a lot, but ritual is something you come to with reverence and more respect because you want it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a distinct difference when you're investing in your self-care with that intention and that discipline. And that's what these 21 individuals really impressed me with, right? Is it when things get hard, when life gets difficult, like they lean in even harder to their self-care practices because that's what they know will bring them through it. There's a confidence in the investment that they've made in creating that approach, which I think is fantastic.
Well, you brought this up from the guy who owned, I think his name was Jim, who owned Boston Pizza. He had quite a crash that brought him back to where he realized he needed to really embrace. You said all 21 of these people used all 7 of the rituals, right? Is that correct?
Correct. Correct. Okay. Yeah.
So how many of these mentors, these 21 people that you interviewed, how many of them had a crash before they came to where they are now? Did they arrive at perfection earlier, or was there something like Jim's story and a lot of their own histories?
You know, all of their formulas were born out of adversity and difficulty. And what I found interesting, Kamika Bingham, who's a world-class sprinter, one of Canada's fastest women, she's the youngest of the mentors. When we met, she was 27. And the rest are, there's a couple in their 40s and the rest are over 50. And those over 50 sort of believed you needed to be over 50 to have any sense of what needed to be in your formula and what worked, just to get to know yourself. Jan Arden is one of the other mentors, and she's an award-winning musician and TV personality. And she's quite funny about, like, you don't know yourself. You got to fall into a ditch enough times and pick yourself up to have any sense of what works, right? So another one of the mentors is Herbie Kuhn, and Herbie is the chaplain for the Toronto Argonauts, as well as Athletics Canada and the Toronto Raptors. And in his practice with athletes, he really focuses on what he calls the total athlete, which is mental, physical, social, emotional, and spiritual well-being. And at the end of 2020, Herbie found himself the furthest he'd ever been personally from that version of the total athlete. And he couldn't look his athletes in the eye with any sense of purpose or integrity and hold them accountable when he himself couldn't. Like, he couldn't walk to the end of the block with his dog and his son without being winded. And it was an embarrassing moment for him. And he tells his story in this book about how he used that as leverage to gradually build himself back. Robin Hanley Defoe, who's the stress resiliency expert, had a very fractured relationship with food, eating disorder, and mental health issues that she brought herself back with incredible resiliency and now is literally a resiliency, world-renowned resiliency expert. So I think it's important. The human experience is difficult and challenging, and these individuals have learned to embrace those challenges. And in doing so, they're constantly, as I said, fine-tuning and modifying their approach, looking to stay on top of the research and tweak their approach as necessary.
Yeah. All right. 2 rituals left. What's number 6?
That's nurture mental fitness. And this is all about looking at the practices of stress resiliency with getting stuck in chronic stress. We get locked into that fight or flight response. And research shows that can amplify centers of the brain, more primitive centers of the brain that are emotional centers that are tied into the stress response and can limit activity in our prefrontal cortex where we're doing more creative and strategic thinking. And as we get locked into that fight or flight response, that stress response, we start looking at our world, looking for threats. It changes our perspective. And the research clearly shows that stress is enhancing versus stress is debilitating mindset has a huge impact on our physiology. So I've worked with mental health experts in designing a stress resiliency strategy to bring this ritual and focus of getting proactive in support of our mental health.
I'm going to have you unpack this one because this is an area I like to spend a lot of time talking about.
Right.
Neuroplasticity. Right. So talk to me about stress resiliency for you or for these mentors.
Right. So as I met with these individuals, I had just come through the first year of COVID in Canada. The restrictions were quite profound. And so our practice was shut down to urgent care only. The restrictions were very intense and controlled. And as people came out of 2020 into 2021 and restrictions gradually started to change and lift, there was a real shift in mindset patients were frustrated and wanting to determine to come out of the pandemic with it meaning something, right? There was a determination there that really struck me as a difference and frankly was one of the motivators for me to write this book. I said, now is the time to bring these stories to life because there was that determination that felt very different. And as I was starting the book, I was also coming through a period of time where I had been stuck in that stress response for a long time myself, and I had let go of some of my resiliency habits. And so it was a great experience. My personal journey was in understanding how I needed to regulate my sleep and my nutrition practices to be able to be who I needed to be in my life with my patients and recognize the emotional toll being a healthcare practitioner on the front lines had through the pandemic. Yeah. So Robin Hanley Defoe and Dr. Ian Daw, both mental health resiliency experts in the book, talk about the importance of belonging, acceptance, perspective, hope, and humor. And we dive into those five pillars in the book as ways to create a resiliency strategy. And that begins with understanding where you move in the course of your day or week on your stress curve. And if you can understand that stress can be a huge advantage, and we can use that stress to call on our best performance on demand when we understand how as stress increases, performance increases. But we get to a point where we hit our plateau, and that peak, if we look to establish that peak as our norm, as where we need to be every day to survive a day, well, it's just not sustainable. And that's where chronic stress gets ugly and starts to have a significant impact on health and performance. So the mentors do an extraordinary job of always knowing where they are on their stress response curve. And they use their formula and their lifestyle practices, their daily rituals of self-care to strategically pull themselves back to the left side of the peak of that curve so that at demand, on demand, they can go back to that peak performance as need be. And that journey starts with understanding, okay, where am I on the curve? What are my triggers? And what voice in my head, what track is playing when I am triggered? Because those thoughts have a huge impact on, again, on physiology and how quickly you ramp up into that stress response curve.
This is a kind of a common theme I see sometimes in high performers. What would you say to high performers that say they don't feel stressed, even though there's clear biomarkers? It's very obvious to everyone else that they're stressed. Mm-hmm. Maybe because their whole life has had some stressful, chaotic elements. So we tend to seek that if we've always had that. So really, like, what would you say to a high performer that is struggling with their own awareness around stress?
Yeah, and you can get addicted to that fast-paced life, right? And that just sort of feels where you need and want to be. And so you'll seek those experiences out. So that's a difficult case, right? For sure. I like to start with, let's talk about how rest and recovery impacts mental health and physical performance. And if I'm working with a professional athlete, then I'll go to their stats and their performance and their injury management. And this is where, as a musculoskeletal expert, quite often I'll work with a patient who has a recurrent hamstring injury or lower back injury. And as we fix those issues, like there's underlying issue, right? They're not sleeping enough, or their nutrition's not on point, or there's something else going on in their life emotionally that's creating issues in their recovery. And so there's a natural opportunity to then have a conversation. And I lean towards explaining the biology and the physiology as a way to gain access to understanding the why you need to do something. And so that would be my approach there, because you're not going to get someone to slow down that just wants to go 100%. Usually they have to be forced to slow down. And I suppose in some respects that the pandemic gave clinicians that opportunity, because people were forced to slow down. And it's in that time that suddenly we all had that people decided they wanted to invest more in self-care. And that's created an opportunity for these types of conversations, which I think is a powerful outcome.
Yeah, I definitely did see that more emphasis on whole health, I think, post that.
Sure.
And I would say I've been slowly generating a mental list of what does it look like to have stress, but to not feel stress. But I mean, it's really, you know, some tricky ones for me, and maybe you, when you go from client to client to client, mouth breathing all day because you're talking, right? Instead of nose breathing. What a sneaky one, right? It's like, oh, well, I don't think I'm stressed doing my job, but it's like, when you talk all day, you can't breathe diaphragmatically
so
as you would like
it's
to.
It's so true.
It's such
so
a sneaky true. One, you know, or more common ones that more people might resonate with also would be just ones I've noticed from people who say that they don't have stress, but they do, you know, the chronic need to respond to something or feel like they need a response to something right away. People who, yeah. who struggle to sit in peace, they might say like, well, I can't meditate. I used to say that all the time. Sometimes yeah. there's just some other pieces around it, or there's just a cooler way to do it, you know, that can work for those brains. But it's an interesting, thing.
One of the mentors, Francois Olivier, senior executive, and he travels the world to many different plants and is constantly on point and entertaining and go, go, go. And I asked him this very question, like, you know, you're in all these different cities, you're constantly on the move. Like, how do you recognize the need to slow down and get off that track? And it's difficult for him because he enjoys that pace, right? So he's predisposed to want to be the life of the party. And when he gets home from travel or he gets back to his hotel, he has a ritual or deliberate practice every night. And that's that he recognizes that I brought my best effort today. I've done all I can do. I'll be better tomorrow if I sleep now. And sleep now will give me a fresher perspective tomorrow. And it's as easy as that for him. He does that and he just disconnects from the need to be going. He sees the value in the recovery because he knows how it's going to impact his performance. So that's his hook. So for some, it's a bit more of a struggle. Yeah. It's that pre-bed ritual. It's that time spent in quiet meditation. I like the Calm app. I think that's, I have a 10-minute Calm meditation that I do at the end of the day. And that meditation at the end of my day and then the movement practice at the beginning of my day are my bookends that really sort of keep me grounded.
Yeah. And sometimes there's just, I think this is the reality for a lot of people. There's some kind of wake-up call that helps them understand like, oh, I'm actually not managing this as well as I thought I was, yeah. right? That's usually, yeah. you know, yeah. falling in the ditch. So seventh ritual, yeah. lay it on us.
That's play with purpose. And this one's probably my favorite. Somewhere along the way, adults forget about the importance of play, and play invigorates us and it stimulates our creativity. It helps enhance our relationships. It eases the burden of stress and is such a vital piece to good health. And the research is showing us that playful adults also happen to be happier, and happier adults are healthier and they have healthier relationships and they're more likely to participate in some of the strategies that we talked about today. But we're also seeing from happiness experts that happiness is actually a choice. And yeah, nature versus nurture may establish a baseline happiness to begin with, but through practices like those promoted by Sean Aker, the author of Happiness Advantage, the happiness expert, there are ways to amplify and elevate happiness by shifting perspective.
Yeah, I think this is easily goes by the wayside sometimes, and it can be hard if you've been in a chronic stress pattern for a long time to mm-hmm. like open up to doing something like this. One of my favorite things to do is accidentally end up out of, not even accidentally, but intentionally end up out of like phone service away from things where you don't have those distractions. It always seems to like reset my neural pathways and my all the things and come back with that fresher perspective. Kind of like the example you used where the guy said, if I just sleep tonight, I have that feeling a lot. I'm like, I will be better tomorrow. I will be a better clinician if I take this break during this time.
I had an experience when I was literally writing this chapter on play with purpose. I went to a friend's barbecue that afternoon and I walked away from the writing. It was a day that I was struggling with it. And my friend's son, he's 3 years old, came up to the group of adults in the backyard and he took my hand and he said, let me show you the potato bugs. His son's name's Gavin. I didn't know Gavin. And so I just sort of followed his lead. And he led me down this path in the back of their backyard. And he bent down and lift up this big rock that was lining the pathway. And underneath this rock were these, like a slug and three potato bugs. And he just lit up. Like he was just like so excited that this world lived under this rock. And he got to share it with this stranger at his house. And the joy on his face left such a mark on me that I came home and I killed the rest of the chapter. But every time I see a potato bug, I laugh or I smile and I think of Gavin and the ripple effect of just how pure and innocent that play and pleasure was by being in the moment. So all of the play experts, all the positive psychologists, they all talk about play being the need for play to be unscripted, right? And so when I say play with purpose, the purpose behind the play is you've got to make it a priority. We have to create times where the phone gets unplugged and you just carve out some me time to do something that makes you happy and spend time with people that make you happy. And when you do that, the ripple effect in mental health and in risk of disease is quite profound. And of course, I go through that the research in the book.
I can't help but wonder, you've got these a fair bit of athletes, it sounds like, that were some of the people that you interviewed in the book. And when their job is to play a game, where do they find play?
Yeah, that's a great question. Often it's completely away from the sport. And those that have children just pour into those experiences of just being a mom or a dad. The sport for them becomes work. And so that they don't look at their sport or their profession as play. And so it's essential that there is a distraction built into their routine well away from the sport. So I think of a number of the football players that I work with, they find joy in travel. They find joy in spending time with family or getting involved in their church community or just something clearly away from football.
You know, we mentioned a little bit about habits versus rituals, but as we kind of wrap up these seven rituals, which I think we dance through beautifully, what do you want people to really know? Or what would you want to leave them with?
Yeah, it's the notion that we have an incredible power by stacking healthy habits. And one of the things that I've learned in working with these individuals is that every day we get to play the game again. Right? So no perfection. These people are not masters of clean living. They've developed a strategy for living that allows them to be their best on most days. And that really resonates with me. I think that's something that there's a real easy on-ramp here. And if we just start to appreciate what happens when we stack healthy habits, and then we start to convert those habits to rituals, so that just becomes our default, that we can really gain control over how the body ages and our risk of disease. And this is the way healthcare is moving. I mean, longevity experts are looking at aging and they're saying, hold on a second, it's not genetically or biologically predetermined. Aging, the triggering of aging, the speed with which we age is really more a byproduct of how biological systems are declining. And by the way, those are largely influenced by lifestyle practices. So it's the power that comes from just stacking healthy choices. That's what I'm trying to do with this book, is just raise awareness.
I want to underline this last thing, even though I could have said a couple things ago, like, okay, that's good. But really with this ritual, you know, there's been a lot of talk about habits. It takes 21 days to build a habit. How do you really hardwire in a ritual, especially when you kind of get off track? What would you say about that?
I'd say that you start. Let's say that the start is, okay, I'm gonna go for a 5-minute walk 5 days this week. And you accomplish that and you recognize that and you celebrate that win. You maybe build in a reward for yourself for accomplishing that win. And then the next week you do it again. And by that 21 day, by that third week or that fourth week, when that 5-minute walk feels normal, some days you've pushed it to a 7-minute walk or a 10-minute walk. By the time you're into that fourth or fifth week, like, you're not fighting to get that walk done. It's just become part of your day. It's like my morning ritual is just my morning ritual because that's what I do in the morning. It's like brushing my teeth. Like, I don't think about doing it anymore. And so it's through practice and it's through the success that you see when you start doing it. And this is why, and you raised this point earlier in our discussion, like, as we onboard some of these strategies, the pace with which we introduce the rituals is important. And where and how you introduce these rituals is also important, because if it's too much and too overwhelming, it's just too much and you don't do anything, right? So what I'm enjoying is patients are reading the book and I'm getting feedback now is that people are coming in and they're like, okay, I went ritual 4 because that's where I know I needed help and where I was really struggling, or I'm really focusing on 1 because my sleep quality is terrible. So like, let's get that done right. Let's figure that out and then gradually build. And so as I've gone through this practice myself of really dialing down to distill how do I want to approach personally these 7 wellness rituals, I mean, it took me close to 18 months to really get it to where I'm proud of my formula and I see the profound impact of the influence they have on one another.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for going over those today. Where can people find you online?
So they'll find the book website, 7wellnessrituals.com, or on Instagram, 7wellnessrituals. And like I said, there's a ton of resources available both on the website and you can link through that on Instagram.
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah. Real pleasure. Thanks for the chat.
Sharing and reviewing this podcast is the best way to help us succeed with our mission to help integrate the best of East and West and empower you to raise the bar on your health story. Just go to reviewthispodcast.com/less-stressed-life. That's reviewthispodcast.com/less-stressed-life. And you'll be taken directly to a page where you can insert your review and hit post.